Hello and welcome to Armenian News Network Grung, Week in Review. Before we begin, we always appreciate your help in reaching a wider audience. So please don't forget to subscribe and like us on whatever platform you listen to us on, and help spread the word by sharing this podcast on your social media channels. Thanks in advance. I'm Hovik Manucharyan, and today with Elspeth Bedrosyan and our panel, we're going to talk about the following major topics. Electoral reforms in Armenia. Journalist Dana Mazalova passes away. The ANSEF reorganizes. MyStep MP Arsen Julfalakian's resignation from parliament. Russian opposition leader Navalny's poisoning and recovery. And finally, we'll spend a little bit of time on what's going on in Baku. We have with us Aspet Kochikyan, who is a senior lecturer of political science and international relations at Bentley University in Massachusetts, where he teaches courses on the Middle East and the former Soviet space. Emil Sanamyan, a senior research fellow at USC's Institute of Armenian Studies, specializing in politics in the Caucasus, with a special focus on Azerbaijan. And Alen Zamanyan, who is a software engineer in Los Angeles, who follows and has analyzed Armenian affairs for over a decade. Hello and welcome, everyone.
Hello.
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 Hi.
The parliament is working on changes to the electoral code and process with the announced intent of making elections more reliable. One example is the proposal to lower the electoral threshold for a party to get into parliament from 5% to 4% and from 7% to 6% for blocs. Another example discussed recently is the effort to clean up Armenia's notoriously problematic voter list by removing people whose identity documents are expired. This might remove up to 200,000 people from the electoral list in the next election. Aspet Kochikyan, can you talk a little bit about Armenia's needs in order to build trust in elections and therefore its democracy? And are you aware of other proposed major changes to the electoral code?
Thank you, Hovik. Well, the issue of electoral reforms has been on Armenia's docket, on Armenia's National Assembly docket for a while now. Actually, in your introduction, when you mentioned about the proposal to lower the threshold, electoral threshold from 5% to 4%, was offered in 2018, right before the parliamentary elections then. And it was rejected, actually. And because of its rejection, two parties actually couldn't cut the threshold, the Republican Party and the Dashnaktuchun, although the Dashnaktuchun got less than the 4% proposal. It is definitely needed. And the more important thing is about the inflated number of the voter registration. If one is to look at the various elections in Armenia in the last couple of years, you would see that on average, the voter turnout has been consistently around 60%, which is a bit problematic because in a country, especially, for instance, in 2017 elections, government and the government at the time, using administrative resources, actually tried to bus and mobilize people to participate in elections, and they didn't get more than 60% voter turnout. Well, in many countries, you would see there is a voter apathy. People don't participating in elections. Usually it hovers around 70% or so. So the number 60% or the 60% voter turnout is a bit of a fishy sort of number, which makes us think. And again, there are no absolute information to rely on. But there is definite problem of cleaning the voter registration list to make sure that people who have left the country or even have passed away or moved away permanently from the country are removed from that list. So this is definitely a welcome sort of proposal to talk about this. The problem is, whom do you consider to be an absentee? If someone's been living in Russia or United States for a year or two, is that person permanently should permanently be removed, their name should be removed from the voter registration list or not? And this is a major issue also for the Yerevan city municipality elections, city council elections, where in 2018, there was only 44% voter turnout. So the problem is more entrenched or is more accentuated in Yerevan, where most of the voters are, or the country's most of the country's voters are. So removing voters who have not been voting or come up with a alternative way of counting them to as a voter registered voter to elect can bolster absolutely a representation Elections, by the way, are not about democracy. Elections are about representation. Elections are only one element of democracy. So the issue of representation might be better suited or might better addressed in this context once you have a cleaner voter feed.
Okay, and I haven't seen the response from the opposition on this, but something tells me that this type of a change would affect a certain class of voters more than others. I was wondering if that has been debated, or if, like, for instance, what I'm thinking is if you are looking for expired passports or identity documents, you would have to be in the system for a long time for those things to happen, and therefore you might affect more older and conservative voters versus younger voters who might vote a certain way in elections. So I was wondering if you've heard anything discussed from that perspective.
Yeah, nothing in specific, although there have been calls for actually changing the electoral system to have a two-round system, meaning when you do not have a single party or a single entity passing, getting the 50% plus one vote, the top two will end up being represented in a second round. And of course, the problem with that is it actually limits representation again, because only the top two parties would be represented. This is, as far as I have been following, there are no major challenges, and there have been no studies actually about the socioeconomic impact. But you are absolutely right, Odi. Usually, people who are absent would be those who are of a lower socioeconomic status, so that's why they have left the country. There are mechanisms, for instance, if you haven't participated in local and national elections for two terms or two rounds before, then you might automatically be sort of deleted from that list. And interestingly, by the way, I think one of the elements or one of the sort of benchmarks to measure voter participation, free voter participation, were the September 2018 Yerevan municipality elections and then December 2018 parliamentary elections. Well, the reason why I'm saying that it's a benchmark because there was less of busing. There was less of government interference. For instance, it's just for you, just for comparison's sake, in 2017 Yerevan municipality election, there were a lot of reports about voters being bused and gathered sort of to go to the polls. In 2018, there wasn't that much. Yet, in 2018, there was 44% voter turnout. Now, this is also important because considering that the Republican Party boycotted the municipality elections. So if we're looking at the voter list, which is in Yerevan, it's about 800,000, 850,000 voters. Representation was, voter turnout was 45%, roughly, which means that there should have been or there could be as much as 200,000 people in Yerevan alone who are not in Yerevan, physically not in Yerevan, even if you offset that by considering that, okay, 200,000 people didn't vote. They willingly did not go to vote. So most of the voting, clearing the voter registration would be in Yerevan, and it needs to be reorganized because there has also been a lot of population movements from regions to Yerevan.
Okay, thank you. Gor Hakopian, a political analyst and consultant in a discussion on CivilNet, emphasized the importance of political consensus while instituting such foundational reforms to ensure that all sides trust the results of future elections. Alan, given that MyStep or ImKyle has an absolute majority in parliament and therefore the ability to unilaterally pass any of these measures, how has the parliamentary and extra-parliamentary opposition reacted to some of these proposals to date?
Thank you, Vic. The extra-parliamentary opposition hasn't had a chance to participate in these discussions. In general, I mean, electoral reform is a kind of a constant thing. It's not the electoral code is not static. It's changed over the course of the last 30 years, and it's a welcome change to move it further in the right direction. But yeah, the wider the consensus, the political consensus, I think the better the result will be, and more people will trust the outcome of the elections. But yeah, I mean, electoral codes, elections are a very complicated thing. There's no one size fits all, or there's no solution that will satisfy all sides. I mean, there are things that we can agree on. For instance, cleaning up the voter list is obviously a positive thing. There may be some pitfalls there, but I mean, if you do it in a very calculated way, if you use the right heuristics, you could potentially do a good job of cleaning up the list. I just want to point out that in the past, in the 2017 election, for the first time, the results of all the voters were published after the election. And also, Everybody had a chance to go and check the voter lists beforehand. So there was actually a website. You could type in your name even if you weren't in the country, and you could determine if you were on the voter list and request that you be removed from the voter list. So this, some of these mechanisms were already in place, but certainly this is a move that is welcome. It's a welcome change. Some of the other things that are being considered, whether to use an open or a closed party list, whether to have this stable majority clause in there. I think these are things that are open to discussion, and ultimately it's a good thing to have these discussions. And the broader the consensus is, I think the better for trust in the elections.
So I think there has to be kind of a come to Jesus moment on this issue, on the issue of election cleanliness and overall rhetoric on it that we've heard over many, many years from the Armenian political opposition, which is now part of it. Nikol Pashinyan is in the government and represents the government of Armenia. So the underlying notion of Armenian election fraud was that the Armenian government over many years had exaggerated the size of the Armenian population. And that real Armenian population was closer to, or even less than 2 million people rather than closer to 3 million people. Now we have a new government. The new government has maintained the same statistics personnel and same election commission personnel pretty much as the previous government. And the last election had gone under the same assumption in terms of the population size and in terms of turnout based on that population. So it turns out that over many years, Armenian people has been lied to primarily by the opposition press in terms of the size of the Armenian population, that it was indeed closer to 3 million people as officially is, known. I mean, unless there is a new set of data that could be produced and, they could prove otherwise, this is the reality. So I think that that's a very important issue that has not been addressed in terms of sort of both the current government, former opposition, and the previous government, current opposition, coming clean on this issue. On one hand, certainly there was the authoritarian methods done to bring out the voters or bribery, etc. But on the other hand, you also had this wild claims, just as in 2008 election when Nikol Pashinyan claimed that Armenian government produced 500,000 fake passports to give Serzh Sargsyan 500,000 additional votes, which was a totally baseless claim. So that's the point I wanted to make. There has to be a cleanup in terms of all politicians coming on this issue and basically agreeing to some basic facts, like how many people live in Armenia, what is the legitimate turnout, and what are the legitimate methods of election struggle.
Okay.
And just to add on Emil's, I think the methodology of census that has been done, taken in Armenia is also problematic in a sense that they wouldn't count those people who are living abroad. They would count them as still residents. That's why the number seems to be higher, even though there might be people who have left semi-permanently.
There's probably some of it, but I think by and large, Armenian population statistics do account for the immigration for people who have emigrated from Armenia, even those who maintain the Armenian citizenship.
The allegation is, though, those people who are out of the country somehow, let's say they've moved out, the government is somehow using their identity to falsify election results. And that's a little bit more far-fetched to me.
There have been cases, Hovik, but not mass.
Mass cases. And
right.
I think from year to year, it'd be interesting to see the results. But I think that type of falsification has gone down, actually, based on official statistics.
Yeah, there's no doubt that it has. The more transparency there is in the process, less falsification like that is possible.
The funny thing is that also the opposition over the last few decades has always said that Armenian citizens living outside of Armenia should have the right to vote, and that they'll always vote opposition. And now they're cleaning up the lists, which will probably do the opposite. I mean, they can't vote remotely anyway, but this is also potentially removing their chance to go to Armenia and vote.
On to the next topic. So this past week, Czech journalist Dana Mazalova passed away. She covered Nagorno-Karabakh extensively, and President Sarkisian, the HR ombudsman of Artsakh, Prime Minister Pashinyan, and also the foreign minister of Armenia, all extended condolences over her death. Emil, as an expert on Karabakh war, you probably read much of Mazalova's work. Would you share your thoughts?
Yes, sure. I mean, I can't say, I don't know Mazalova personally. I can't say I really read a lot of her work. She certainly was part of the sort of this journalistic pool that were friends of Armenia long before the Karabakh conflict. She first came to Armenia in the early 80s and then came again right after the earthquake with assistance, a group from Czechoslovakia at the time. So certainly she came to Karabakh conflict as a person very much connected to Armenia, as a friend of Armenia, as there were several people like that. We can think of Tsvetana Paskalyeva, we can think of some Russian journalists that have extensively covered Armenia at the time. So when you come, when you kind of go native on the sort of subjects of conflicts, it's very hard to maintain a very neutral objective. What she managed to do, though, is while it was still possible, she did travel to Azerbaijan back in 1991, 1992. She was able to interview President Mutalibov at the time. She was able to collaborate with probably the most prominent journalist of Azerbaijan at the time, Chingiz Mustafayev. So that's what makes her unusual. She didn't just stay in Armenia. She did try to go to Azerbaijan and to work there. However, I have to say, from my perspective, I do think she was very much, I don't want to use the word biased, but certainly her accents were in favor of Armenia and sometimes at the expense of the fact. So this whole interview with Mutalibov, Mutalibov was never a source of ultimate truth on any subject matter. It has become sort of this trump card in Armenia's arguments over Hoxha Ali with Azerbaijan that, oh, Mutalibov told Mazalova this and that. Mutalibov, even if he had the complete information, he was a politician with his own political position, etc. So in terms of investigating what caused the civilian deaths around near Hoxha Ali, or near Agdam actually, in February 1992, you would probably want to actually talk to people who were there and who survived it, etc., rather than Mutalibov, who was considerable distance away, and obviously his assessments would be colored by his political position at the time.
Emil, as you mentioned, Mutalibov and Azerbaijani authorities today deny the accuracy of the interview, and some scholars and journalists agree with this. One journalist we all know and respect went as far as to claim that she was engaging in war crime denialism and claimed that Mutalibov is delusional, to quote them. But besides her interview, as you briefly touched upon, do we have other documentary evidence to date or scholarly research that can further shed light on this inexorable part of her legacy?
Which part of her legacy? That particular interview with Mutalibov, or what?
Yes. And I guess the wider Hoxha Ali events.
I have to say, it's that interview has been made into much more than it should be. It was just an interview. I mean, many interviews have been... in a way, it's Armenia's response in to sort of Tom Dowal's interview with Serge Sargsyan, where he is also sort of misspeaking on the subject matter in a way that considerably inaccurate. He talked about the fact that Hoxha Ali coincided with the Armenian massacres in Sumgayit and somehow made that connection between Sumgayit and Hoxha Ali. Two different events, and the coincidence of those events is just that coincidence, because there was another logic of to Armenian actions in February 1992, considerably different from, so to speak, Azerbaijani actions in February 1988 in Sumgayit. So this sort of PR actions by Armenian government in response to Azerbaijani government, I don't think they really help clean things up in terms of the legacy of this incident, which is a very legitimate subject matter, because so many civilians died there, hundreds of civilians died in that area. So my perspective was always, if we want to take this conflict into a different direction, it has to start with the acknowledgement that the other side's civilians suffered, and there has to be respect and recognition in that sense, independent of whether those deaths were directly caused by Armenian actions or indirectly caused by the Armenian actions. Because I, having looked at this issue, I have to say that the responsibility for those deaths is shared by Armenians and Azerbaijanis. Civilians were caught in a crossfire between two lines of contact. So there is Armenian share of responsibility. Cannot be thrown away just because Mutalibov said something in some interview. It makes no sense.
All right. Thank you. Osped?
All right. Last week, the Armenian National Science and Education Fund announced a reorganization. First, it has renamed itself after its founding father, so they're now the Yerevan Terzian, Armenian National Science and Education Fund. And they're also established an advisory board to their executive board to allow their organization greater agility and depth of focus. Aspet Kochigyan, are you familiar with the ANSEF, their mission and their output?
Not intimately familiar, but when I had a short stint in upstate New York in Ithaca, I actually managed to get to know many of the people who were involved in this, including Professor Terzian, who was the founding father of the ANSEF. And at the time, there were a lot of Armenian students from Armenia specifically, that he managed to gather to coalesce around him, mostly in sciences. Terzian himself is an astrophysicist, and he actually, interesting fact, the recording on Voyager 1, there's the gold record on Voyager 1, which has greetings in many, many languages, and the Armenian recording was recorded by his wife, Araxi. So he was also very much involved in that project. Now, the ANSEF, basically, ANSEF, has been very active in collaboration with various fields or various disciplines in Armenia, including mostly focusing on natural sciences, engineering, physical sciences, and to a lesser extent on humanities as well. And the connection that they have, individual connection and as well as collective, they have developed a lot of collaborative projects with Armenia. I think it's one of the better examples of scientific research, collaboration, and assistance between collectives within the diaspora and Armenia.
Aspet, do you know their sources of funding? Because I think they say that they've given $2 or $3 million in the last 19, 20 years.
Well, I don't think it is theirs. It's actually FARS, Fund for Armenian Relief, because they operate within the context of Fund for Armenian Relief. I'm not sure if that is the number for the foundation. Rather, it might be for the fund. It's not for ANSEF. Rather, it's for coming from FAR. So they're probably, I'm not very familiar with FAR's missions and projects, but this is one of their flagship projects.
Thank you. Ovik?
Okay, let's turn to a more domestic issue. So former wrestling champ and MyStep MP Arsen Julfalakyan has resigned from his seat in the parliament, citing irreconcilable differences with the Minister of Education. The 29-year-old acting mayor of Gapan, Narek Gharamanyan, will replace Julfalakyan. Alan, do we know anything about these fundamental differences that caused Julfalakyan to part ways with the ruling party? And what do we know about Gharamanyan?
Thanks, Ovik. I don't know much about Gharamanyan, but I did want to speak a little bit about Julfalakyan and his decision. So, first of all, the Aray Karutunyan, who's the education minister, he was appointed a couple of years ago after the change of government, and this was the result of combining a few ministries. So he's kind of like a super minister. He took over the education and science ministry, plus the culture, and then they add through in sport. So he's covering a lot of ground here. And in the last 2 years, there's been a lot of controversy over some of the decisions he's made in most of these areas, especially education. There's a lot of changes in education that are coming that have had basically a lot of opposition to it. So even like Bright Armenia Party right now is asking for the minister's resignation, and that's a parliamentary party. So
my understanding is Julfalakyan was a member of Bargavaj Hayastan, and after the 2018 changes, he switched sides, essentially dumping, you know, people were actually shocked that he dumped Sarukyan. And there's an extensive interview on Para TV about this. But what's interesting, though, is, you know, is this a sign that he still sort of has some allegiance to Tsarukyan, or is this agenda of having some differences with the Minister of Education a real agenda?
Julfalakyan himself didn't specify any of the details of what disagreements he had with the ministry. I mean, there are objective and subjective criticisms of Aray Karutunyan's work, but there's definitely a lot of discontent. And the fact that Bright Armenia, who used to be a coalition partner, is now bringing the issue of Aray Karutunyan's resignation to parliament means that there is, at least in terms of public opinion, there's a lot of discontent. Specifically, as far as like why he resigned, he didn't specify what the disagreements were. One of the other parliamentarians, Sofia Hovsepian, she said that the disagreement had to do with specifically not Aray Karutunyan, but one of his deputies in charge of sport. So he said that she said that there was disagreement related to their policies on sport specifically. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that Julfalakian himself, you know, he hasn't been a very active parliamentarian. He's a very, very accomplished, you know, wrestler, universally liked, but he hasn't been very active as a parliamentarian. He kind of highlights the fact that the MyStep bloc is just not a very cohesive bloc. It's just, you know, they kind of brought in a lot of popular people or some popular people just to get more votes. There's no real ideological, you know, base for this party. There's a lot of different blocks within that party, and Julfalakian is in, you know, one of those blocks.
I'd also like to mention a great interview we posted on Grung of Julfalakian back in July. We'll link to it in the show notes. It didn't match my hidden bias of a famous athlete in politics. In addition to sports, he has quite an interesting academic background. The interview also touched upon Julfalakian's relationship with Gagik Zarukyan and his decision to represent prosperous Armenia, or Bargavajhayastan, and his subsequent decision to jump ship to MyStep or Imkhail. Alan, anything else you want to add?
The other thing I feel like this points out is, you know, parliament, the job of parliament is to oversee the work of the government. And this is, you know, a member of the ruling party or the ruling faction leaving the parliament because of disagreements with a minister in the government. And that just doesn't, you know, it's not a good sign in terms of transparency. We don't really know why he left. We don't know what the disagreements were. Parliamentarians should be able to get up in front of parliament and kind of voice his concerns, ask questions to government. This didn't really happen. He kind of abruptly left, which points to maybe a more fundamental problem, bigger maybe disagreement within the faction, and I'm guessing we may see more of this to come.
Okay, moving on. The German government said last week that it knows the origin of the poison that was used on Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny, but will not disclose it, expecting that Russia will come clean. Navalny came out of a medically induced coma on September 7 and has regained consciousness. Reportedly, he speaks and remembers the day of poisoning and is expected to physically recover at least 90%. Asbet Kochigyan, this is not the first time a Russian opposition figure or oligarch drinks bad tea or has poison for breakfast. How important is Navalny, especially for the EU? Because I find it interesting that Navalny got whisked away so quickly to Germany for detox and revival. So I'm thinking maybe the EU has some deep-rooted interests here?
Right. One thing we have to understand that Navalny has been able to galvanize Russian politics even before, I mean, for the last couple of years, coming across as probably the most viable candidate, the most viable opposition candidate to Putin. A viable as well as genuine opposition. During previous elections or previous presidential elections in Russia, there were a couple of other candidates who actually managed to throw in their hats, but many observers argued that it's actually a ruse by the government to divert attention. But Navalny himself is definitely considered to be in the West as the most viable alternative, most viable opposition member to Putin's regime. And as well as internally, domestically, where his popularity is based on videos, YouTube rather than on media, and something that the Russian government hasn't been able to control, considering that the Russian government controls all traditional outlets of media, TV, radio, and so on. So he relied on YouTube's and social media to get the message out. Now, in terms of the second part or the insinuation of the question, probably if it was done purposefully or not, consciously or not, but to what extent Navalny is being groomed by the West, by the EU, by the Europeans to become a Russian sort of bolstered Russian opposition figure, I'm not sure that I agree with that. At the end of the day, Navalny is probably not more than a mild headache for Putin rather than a serious contestant for his power. And it's funny that you mentioned historically, I have to also realize that, you know, the way that Lenin was sent back to Russia to start the revolution was through the Germans, who put him in a wagon, in a train wagon, and sent him to Russia to basically start a revolution and weaken the government from within. So it's only a matter of fact that it's a matter of time to wait and see what he will be. And one of the things is that makes me cautious about it is that their caution, the caution by the Europeans and by Navalny, there have been no direct accusations. It's an indirect accusation that it is Russian, but without going into a lot of details. If it was, he was going to be an icon for a revolution, they might have ended up trumpeting it up much faster and with much more fanfare.
Emil, outside of the obvious human factor here, how much do we care about this incident from an Armenian political standpoint? What are Armenia's ties to Navalny if he survives the poisons and arrows of outrageous fortune and by opposing them somehow becomes the master of Russia one day? What does that mean for us?
Well, I hope he would not become a master of Russia. I don't think he ever wanted to become a master of Russia. Certainly, today he's the most viable, you know, native, organic political force in Russia, challenging the existing system, the Putin regime that's been in power for 20 years. Certainly, things happening at that level in Russia are of considerable interest and importance, not just for Armenia, but the world. The challenge for the Russian people, Russian public, what to do after Putin is very real. Putin is a very healthy person, but no one is going to live forever. And I'm sure he realizes that. And if you look at it from the perspective of the need to change Russia, and that need has been recognized and has been acknowledged by Putin himself, you know, you need this sort of moment of change to be a legitimate moment of change, and it's not just going to be, you know, Putin handing power over to one of his lackeys, be that, you know, Medvedev or Mishustin or somebody like that. And it has to be a legitimate individual with a spine. If you try to draw parallels to what the significance of Navalny in Russia today, it's sort of a combination of what Nikol Pashinyan and Edik Bagdasarian of Hetk Investigative Media were in Armenia. So if you look at it from perspective of sort of larger business interests and larger maybe political groupings, Navalny does not appear to be a major figure in that sense. His support base is probably still within 10% or maybe 15-20% now. And that was the case with Nikol Pashinyan. You know, he was never more popular than that until the revolutionary moment, arrived. And I don't subscribe to this conspiratorial theories, be that about Lenin or about Navalny, in the sense that the Germans sent Lenin to Russia to cause havoc there. No, I mean, Lenin was self-made man. He was a person who had particular ideas about how to change Russia. Navalny is a self-made man has his ideas about how to change Russia. So that I can't think of a moment in Russian history in the future of when Putin comes to a realization that he cannot hold on to power anymore and he has to hand it over and say something along the lines of what Serge Sargsyan said, you know, I was wrong and I don't know, Navalny was right, and hand it over to somebody like Navalny. And I think from his perspective, Navalny does represent some cohesive sort of Russian patriotic position. Versus, say, some other Russian opposition figures who have basically emigrated to the West, be that, the former political prisoner, the name was escaping me, the former UKOS president, who is living in Switzerland now, or, I don't know, somebody like Garry Kasparov, who is living in New York now. So it's, Navalny is very important, and he's very important, primarily important for Russia. Also, of course, events in Russia are important for Armenia. Navalny doesn't have direct connections to Armenia beyond his appreciation of the Armenian Revolution in the last couple of years. Beyond that, you know, he's a very informed individual, very well-educated individual that is aware of sort of Russian, broader Russian interests. If you look at his reaction to, the events in Crimea, in Ukraine, you could see a difference between his approach and the approach of many of the liberal opposition in Russia, which denounced Putin's annexation of Crimea. He was much more cautious about that. He realized that there was a genuine Russian interest there and also genuine demand by people in Crimea to be part of Russia. So he wasn't able to sort of denounce it in a way that some of the liberals did. And I'm sure that his views on the Caucasus and the Russian interest in the Caucasus most likely will not diverge very much from Putin's.
So unlike with Putin, we don't have any specific ties to Navalny from the Armenian political elite.
I'm not aware of them. There might be some journalistic type collaboration that has happened with his sort of media, the anti-corruption organization. But beyond that, I'm not aware of that.
Just one thing I want to add for historical context. I never insinuated that Lenin or Navalny are not self-made men. But the fact remains that Lenin, who was an anti-war activist living in Switzerland, was allowed to go through German territory to go to Russia, and the German authorities sealed the wagon so that he doesn't escape. And their point was that once he get there, the anti-war movement would gain momentum, and they will actually remove the Kerensky government at the time, provisional government, out of the war. So I do not in any way undermine Navalny's or Lenin's self-made man, and no conspiratorial theories there.
Yeah, there's always a coincidence of interest like that, but, you know, it's impossible to avoid that.
Finally, let's talk a little bit about all the noise coming out of Baku the last few weeks. During the July war, Ilham Aliyev replaced his foreign minister and instructed the new one to take an aggressive stance in making progress towards Karabakh. Aliyev and his ministers have since upped the level of friction with countries that have anything to do with the supply of arms to Armenia, for example, Serbia, Iran, and especially Russia. After talking to Putin, Aliyev recently rebuked him about it. Of course, all the time, Azerbaijan is outspending Armenia 10-1 in defense spending and has been meeting constantly with Turkey and Israel over its own arms supply and technology. Emil, why is so much effort spent by Azerbaijan on countries associated with supplying arms to Armenia, especially such harsh rhetoric towards Russia? Do you predict there is a qualitative change in Azerbaijan's foreign policy, or is this a reactive tactic for their domestic consumption after a poor military performance in July?
I think I have to say that the rhetoric towards Russia was more robust than it has been for a while. However, we don't have to go very far back into the history of Russian-Azerbaijani relations or the Karabakh conflict to see that it used to be Azerbaijani official rhetoric towards Russia used to be much harsher. It had become mellowed considerably since 2008 war. After Azerbaijan was Aliyev was very intimidated by Russian conduct in South Ossetia, Georgia. So after that, you had a significant mellowing of Azerbaijani rhetoric, and since then, there's been great effort by Azerbaijan to basically win over Russian support on the Karabakh issue, and they thought they could do it with massive purchases of weaponry, various sort of investments or bribes that they've showered our Russian officials with. However, they came back frustrated from this effort. You could see those signs of frustration also with the rhetoric about Foreign Minister Lavrov, the fact that his father was ethnic Armenian or some other Armenian people in the Russian hierarchy, attacked in Azerbaijani media very harshly just last year and before that, and since 2016 war, etc. So you've had this kind of attacks from Azerbaijan before, and you had this in general sort of vacillation between more pro-Russian or more Russia-centric position to more Turkey-centric position, and this game is continuing. So if you look at Aliyev's mindset, his mindset is much closer to mindset of Vladimir Putin than it is to the mindset of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan is a very foreign character for Aliyev, just like Aliyev is a foreign character for Erdogan. So I can't see Aliyev throwing his lot entirely with Erdogan or entirely with Turkey. But you do see a correction of the course happening in the last few months. In light of this outcome of the July fighting also, you have a sense of vulnerability by Aliyev, and he's trying to compensate for that sense by bringing in more Turkish presence in terms of the exercises, in terms of there was just a discussion of possibly creating a joint media platform, propaganda platform with Turkey.
Emil, so what do you make of Armenia's silence? Should they spend a little bit of time on PR and discuss the dollars spent by both countries on defense?
It's not about dollars spent. It's about the fact that the Armenian government...
They should say that Armenia has a right to defend itself, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. But the problem has been a history of Armenian foreign ministry and Armenian governments being mute on subjects of very important subjects, such as Israeli weapon sales to Azerbaijan, Russian weapon sales, or Ukrainian weapon sales. I've never seen a considerable effort to try to, undermine those sales, or at least raise a political price for them to the degree possible. Like I said, with Russia, with Israel, there's room to work, and that work has not been done by and large. Not because it's hard to convince other countries not to sell to Azerbaijan, it's just the effort hasn't been made to try to do that. So there is definitely room to work.
Let's talk about the scene in Baku. Azerbaijan arrested Musavat Party leader Tofiq Yaroglu in March. Last month, they arrested Eldar Hasanov, their ambassador to Serbia, on corruption charges. Azerbaijan has seen an intensification of a domestic political struggle between Ramiz Mehdiyev, Ali Hasanov, and other long-serving officials under the father and son Aliyevs on one hand, and a cadre of younger, rising officials associated with Ilham Aliyev's wife, Mehriban Aliyeva. The picture is even more complicated because some of Aliyev's own people, for example, Mehdiyev, who was sacked last year from his position as Aliyev's right-hand man, are suspected of being pro-Russian and possibly working against Aliyev, but not necessarily being in Aliyeva's camp. Can you talk a little bit about what the dynamics are over there driving their domestic politics?
Yeah, sure. In terms of Azerbaijani politics, if the country is run by one family, basically, husband, wife, and their children. However, there's always been an effort by both Ilham Aliyev and his father, he learned from his father, Heydar Aliyev, to have at least a couple of, or sometimes three groups of the sort of regime groups that would sort of check each other in terms of influence, they would have, for example, chief of police of the country at loggerheads with the chief of police of Baku, and chief of the KGB at loggerheads with the chief of presidential intelligence service, which is a separate organization. So there would always be those sort of checks and balances within the regime. So in this case, too, you have this effort by Ilham Aliyev to, at some points, to curtail influences of groups that are closer on his wife's family side versus his father's family side. So in this case, Ramiz Mehdiyev, is an old man now, 82 years old. It was time for him to leave the government. He was retired with substantial honors. He got Heydar Aliyev order, etc. But the government is full of the people who were appointed by him, and they're naturally distrusted by Ilham Aliyev and Mehriban Aliyev and their side of the family. He's been turned into scapegoat, another scapegoat that the Aliyevs will use to justify reasons for why country's corrupt and why there are so many injustices, just like a foreign minister has been, scapegoated for, the fact that allegedly the diplomats aren't doing their job in terms of Karabakh conflict, or some of the military people have and will be scapegoated for setbacks, military setbacks. So this is how dictatorships operate. They're never to blame. They cannot be defeated in the elections, but they can create these mechanisms, these procedures that they engage in to show the public at large that if it wasn't for some of the bad implementers, things would have been much better, and all of these grand plans that they had presented, and the notions that Armenia is just about to collapse that had been repeated for 20 years by Aliyevs, or that Azerbaijan will win, etc., have not come true just because there's just this fifth column or some old officials or some nefarious Armenian lobby somewhere. So that's how the picture, how that regime has operated to date over many years, and they will try to continue to operate until system collapse.
Finally, we read that Armenia will join Russia, China, Belarus, Iran, Myanmar, Pakistan, and some other countries for the Caucasus 2020 joint military exercises scheduled to take place next week, September 21 to 26 in Russia. India and Azerbaijan have opted out, both citing COVID-19 concerns. What are the real reasons for their non-participation?
I can't speculate for India, but for Azerbaijan, it seems to me that most likely this is another kind of démarche that was part of the earlier démarche, that they were unhappy with the fact that Russia took this position that even though as Margarita Simonyan articulated, they don't like Pashinyan. They basically find Pashinyan very objectionable. They would still support Armenia in the conflict with Azerbaijan because that's their treaty obligation.
Well, that's the show this week. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Emil. Asped.
Bye, guys.
Alan, thank you very much.
And that concludes our Grung Week in Review. We hope it has helped your understanding of some of the issues from the previous week. We look forward to your feedback and suggestions for issues to cover in greater depth. Contact us on our website at grung.org, that's G-R-O-O-N-G, or on our Facebook page, ANN-Grung, or in our Facebook group, Grung-Armenian News Network. Special thanks to Laura Osborne for providing the music for our podcast. I'm Hovik Manucharyan, and on behalf of everyone in this episode, I wish you a good week. Thank you for listening, and talk to you next week.